narrow structure of brown jagged stone and thick blue glass was 50 yards down the block. Blankets and straps in place, an already weary, slow-witted laborer walked behind a well-dressed couple toward it. He reached the concrete steps as two muscular men, one black, one white, were carrying a covered harp out the door. Bourne stopped and called out, his words halting, his dialect coarse.
"Hey, where's Dugan?"
"What the hell do you think?"
replied the white, angling his head around.
"Sitting in a fucking chair."
"He ain't gonna lift nothing heavier than that clipboard, man," added the black. "He's an executive. Ain't that right, Joey?"
"He's a crumball, is what he is.
What you got there?"
"Schumach sent me," said Jason. "He wanted another man down here and figured you needed this stuff. Told me to bring it."
"Marie the Menace," laughed the black. "You new man. I ain't seen you before. You come from Shape Up."
"Yeah."
"Take that shit up to the executive," grunted Joey, starting down the steps.
"He can allocate it. How about that, Pete? Allocate. You like it?"
"I love it, Joey. You a regular dictionary."
Bourne walked up the reddish-brown steps past the descending movers to the door. He stepped inside and saw the winding staircase on the right and the long, narrow corridor in front of him that led to another door 30 feet away. He had climbed those steps 1,000 times, walked up and down that corridor thousands more. He had come back, and an overpowering sense of dread swept through him. He started down the dark, narrow corridor. He could see shafts of sunlight bursting through a pair of French doors in the distance. He was approaching the room where Cain was born. That room. He gripped the straps on his shoulder and tried to stop the trembling. Marie leaned forward in the back seat of the armor-plated government sedan, the binoculars in place. Something had happened. She was not sure what it was, but she could guess. A short, stocky man had passed by the steps of the brownstone a few minutes ago, slowing his pace as he approached the general, obviously saying something to him. The man had then continued down the block, and seconds later, Crawford had followed him. Conklin had been found. It was a small step if what the general said was true. Hired gunmen, unknown to their employer, he unknown to them. Hired to kill a man, for all the wrong reasons. Oh God, she loathed them all. Mindless, stupid men. Playing with the lives of other men, knowing so little, thinking they knew so much. They had not listened. They never listened until it was too late, and then only with stern forbearance and strong reminders of what might have been. Had things been as they were perceived to be, which they were not? The corruption came from blindness, the lies from obstinacy and embarrassment. Do not embarrass the powerful. The napalm said it all. Marie focused the binoculars. A Belkin's man was approaching the steps, blankets and straps over his shoulder, walking behind an elderly couple, obviously residents of the block, out for a stroll. The man in the field jacket and the black knit hat stopped. He began talking to two other movers carrying a triangular-shaped object out the door. What was it? There was something odd. She could not see the man's face. It was hidden from view, but there was something about the neck, the angle of the head. What was it? The man started up the steps, a blunt man, weary of his day before it had begun. A slovenly man. Marie removed the binoculars. She was too anxious, too ready to see things that were not there. Oh God, my love, my Jason. Where are you? Come to me. Let me find you. Do not leave me for these blind, mindless men. Do not let them take you from me. Where was Crawford? He had promised to keep her informed of every move, everything. She had been blunt. She did not trust him, any of them. She did not trust their intelligence, that word spelled with a lowercase I. he had promised. Where was he? She spoke to the driver.
Will you put down the window, please? It's stifling in here.
Sorry, miss, replied the civilian-clothed army man. I'll turn on the air conditioning for you, though. The windows and doors were controlled by buttons only the driver could reach. She was in a glass and metal tomb in a sun-drenched, tree-lined street.
I don't believe a word of it, said Conklin, limping angrily across the room back to the window. He leaned against the sill, looking out, his left hand pulled up to his face, his teeth against the knuckle of his index finger. Not a goddamn word.
You don't want to believe it, Alex, countered Crawford. The solution is so much easier. It's in place and so much simpler.
You didn't hear that tape. You didn't hear Villiers.
I've heard the woman. She's all I have to hear. She said we didn't listen. You didn't listen.
Then she's lying.
Awkwardly, Conklin spun around.
Christ, of course she's lying. Why wouldn't she? She's his woman. She'll do anything to get him off the meat hook.
You're wrong, and you know it. The fact that he's here proves you're wrong, proves I was wrong to accept what you said. Conklin was breathing heavily, his right hand trembling as he gripped his cane. He did not finish. Instead, he looked at Crawford helplessly.
We ought to let the solution stand?
Asked the officer quietly.
You're tired, Alex. You haven't slept for several days. You're exhausted. I don't think I heard that.
No.
The CIA man shook his head, his eyes closed, his face reflecting his disgust.
No, you didn't hear it, and I didn't say it. I just wish I knew where the hell to begin.
I do, said Crawford, going to the door and opening it. Come in, please. The stocky man walked in, his eyes darting to the rifle leaning against the wall. He looked at the two men, appraisal in his expression.
What is it?
The exercise has been called off, Crawford said.
I think you must have gathered that.
What exercise?
I was hired to protect him.
The gunman looked at Alex.
You mean you don't need protection anymore, sir?
You know exactly what we mean, broke in Conklin. All signals are off, all stipulations.
What stipulations? I don't know about any stipulations.
The terms of my employment are very clear. I'm protecting you, sir.
Good. Fine, said Crawford. Now what we have to know is who else out there is protecting him.
Who else where?
Outside this room, this apartment. In other rooms, on the street, in cars, perhaps. We have to know. The stocky man walked over to the rifle and picked it up.
I'm afraid you gentlemen have misunderstood. I was hired on an individual basis. If others were employed, I'm not aware of them.
You do know them, shouted Conklin. Who are they? Where are they?
I haven't any idea.
Sir.
The courteous gunman held the rifle in his right arm, the barrel angled down toward the floor. He raised it perhaps 2 inches, no more than that, the movement barely perceptible.
If my services are no longer required, I'll be leaving.
Can you reach them? Interrupted the brigadier. We'll pay generously.
I've already been paid generously, sir.
It would be wrong to accept money for a service I can't perform. And pointless for this to continue.
A man's life is at stake out there, shouted Conklin.
So's mine,
said the gunman, walking to the door, the weapon raised higher.
Goodbye, gentlemen.
He let himself out.
Jesus!
Roared Alex, swinging back to the window, his cane clattering against a radiator. What do we do? To start with, get rid of that moving company. I don't know what part it played in your strategy, but it's only a complication now. I can't. I tried. I didn't have anything to do with it. Agency controls picked up our sheets when we had the equipment taken out. They saw that a store was being closed up and told GSA to get us the hell out of there. With all deliberate speed, said Crawford, nodding. The monk covered that equipment by signature. His statement absolves the agency. It's in his files. That'd be fine if we had 24 hours. We don't even know if we've got 24 minutes. We'll still need it. There'll be a Senate inquiry. Closed, I hope. Rope off the street. What? You heard me. Rope off the street. Call in the police. Tell them to rope everything off. Through the agency? This is domestic. Then I will. Through the Pentagon, from the Joint Chiefs, if I have to. We're standing around making excuses when it's right in front of our eyes. Clear the street. Rope it off. Bring in a truck with a public address system. Put her in it. Put her on a microphone. Let her say anything she likes. Let her scream her head off. She was right. He'll come to her. Do you know what you're saying? Asked Conklin. There'll be questions. Newspapers, television, radio. Everything will be exposed. Publicly. I'm aware of that, said the brigadier. I'm also aware that she'll do it for us if this goes down. She may do it anyway, no matter what happens, but I'd rather try to save a man I didn't like, didn't approve of. But I respected him once, and I think I respect him more now. What about another man? If Carlos is really out there, you're opening the gates for him. You're handing him his escape. We didn't create Carlos. We created Cain and we abused him. We took his mind and his memory. We owe him. Go down and get the woman. I'll use the phone. Bourne walked into the large library with the sunlight streaming through the wide, elegant French doors at the far end of the room. Beyond the panes of glass were the high walls of the garden. All around him, objects too painful to look at. He knew them and did not know them. They were fragments of dreams, but solid, to be touched, to be felt, to be used. Not ephemeral at all. A long hatch table where whiskey was poured. Leather armchairs where men sat and talked. Bookshelves that housed books and other things. Concealed things that appeared with the touch of buttons. It was a room where a myth was born, a myth that had raced through Southeast Asia and exploded in Europe. He saw the long, tubular bulge in the ceiling and the darkness came, followed by flashes of light and images on a screen and voices shouting in his ears, "Who is he? Quick! You're too late! You're a dead man! Where is this street? What does it mean to you? Whom did you meet there? Methods of kills. Which are yours? No. You are not Delta. You are not you. You are only what you are here. Became here."
"Hey! Who the hell are you?"
The question was shouted by a large, red-faced man seated in an armchair by the door, a clipboard on his knees. Jason had walked right past him.
"You Dugan?"
Bourne asked.
"Yeah?"
"Schumach sent me. Said you needed another man."
"What for? I got 5 already. And this fucking place has hallways so tight you can't hardly get through them. They're climbing asses now."
"I don't know. Schumach sent me, that's all I know. He told me to bring this stuff."
Bourne let the blankets and the straps fall to the floor.
"Murray sends new junk? I mean, that's new." "I know, Schumach sent you. Ask Schumach.
You can't. He said to tell you he was heading out to Sheep's Head. Be back this afternoon.
Oh, that's great. He goes fishing and leaves me with the shit.
You're new. You a crumb ball from the shape up.
Yeah. That Murray's a beaut.
All I need's another crumb ball. Two wise-ass stiffs and now four crumb balls.
You want me to start in here? I can start in here.
No, asshole. Crumb balls start at the top. You ain't heard? It's further away, capiche?
Yeah, I capiche.
Jason bent down for the blankets and the straps.
Leave that junk here. You don't need it. Get upstairs, top floor, and start with the single wood units. As heavy as you can carry, and don't give me no union bullshit.
Bourne circled the landing on the second floor and climbed the narrow staircase to the third, as if drawn by a magnetic force beyond his understanding. He was being pulled to another room high up in the brownstone, a room that held both the comfort of solitude and the frustration of loneliness. The landing above was dark, no lights on, no sunlight bursting through windows anywhere. He reached the top and stood for a moment in silence.
Which room was it?
There were three doors, two on the left side of the hallway, one on the right. He started walking slowly toward the second door on the left, barely seen in the shadows.
That was it.
It was where thoughts came in the darkness. Memories that haunted him, pained him. Sunlight and the stench of the river and the jungle. Screaming machines in the sky, screaming down from the sky. Oh, God, it hurt. He put his hand on the knob, twisted it, and opened the door. Darkness, but not complete. There was a small window at the far end of the room, a black shade pulled down, covering it, but not completely. He could see a thin line of sunlight, so narrow it barely broke through where the shade met the sill. He walked toward it, toward that thin, tiny shaft of sunlight. A scratch. A scratch in the darkness. He spun, terrified at the tricks being played on his mind. But it was not a trick. There was a diamond-like flash in the air, light bouncing off steel. A knife was slashing up at his face.
I would willingly see you die for what you've done, said Marie, staring at Conklin. And that realization revolts me.
Then there's nothing I can say to you, replied the CIA man, limping across the room toward the general. Other decisions could have been made. By him and by you.
Could they? Where was he to start? When that man tried to kill him in Marseille? In the Rue Sarrazin? When they hunted him in Zurich? When they shot at him in Paris? And all the while he didn't know why. What was he to do?
Come out. God damn it, come out.
He did. And when he did, you tried to kill him.
You were there. You were with him. You had a memory.
Assuming I knew whom to go to, would you have listened to me?
Conklin returned her gaze.
I don't know, he answered, breaking the contact between them and turning to Crawford.
What's happening?
Washington's calling me back within 10 minutes.
But what's happening?
I'm not sure you want to hear it.
Federal encroachment on state and municipal law enforcement statutes. Clearances have to be obtained.
Jesus.
Look. The army man suddenly bent down to the window. The truck's leaving.
Someone got through, said Conklin.
Who?
I'll find out.
The CIA man limped to the phone. There were scraps of paper on the table, telephone numbers written hastily. He selected one and dialed.
Give me Schumach.
Please.
Schumach, this is Conklin, Central Intelligence. Who gave you the word?
The dispatcher's voice on the line could be heard halfway across the room.
What word?
Get off my back. We're on that job and we're gonna finish it. Frankly, I think you're a wacko.
Conklin slammed down the phone.
Christ. Oh, Christ.
His hand trembled as he gripped the instrument. He picked it up and dialed again, his eyes on another scrap of paper.
Petrocelli. Reclamations, he commanded. Petrocelli?
Conklin again.
You faded out. What happened?
No time. Level with me.
That priority invoice from agency controls.
Who signed it?
What do you mean, who signed it?
The top cat who always signs them. McGivern.
Conklin's face turned white.
That's what I was afraid of,
he whispered as he lowered the phone. He turned to Crawford, his head quivering as he spoke.
The order to GSA was signed by a man who retired 2 weeks ago.
Carlos.
Oh, God, screamed Marie. The man carrying the blankets, the straps. The way he held his head, his neck, angled to the right. It was him. When his head hurts, he favors the right. It was Jason. He went inside.
Alexander Conklin turned back to the window, his eyes focused on the black enameled door across the way. It was closed. The hand, the skin, the dark eyes in the thin shaft of light. Carlos. Bourne whipped his head back as the razor-like edge of the blade sliced the flesh under his chin, the eruption of blood streaming across the hand that held the knife. He lashed his right foot out, catching his unseen attacker in the kneecap, then pivoted and plunged his left heel into the man's groin. Carlos spun, and again the blade came out of the darkness, now surging toward him, the line of assault directly at his stomach. Jason sprang back off the ground, crossing his wrists, slashing downward, blocking the dark arm that was an extension of the handle. He twisted his fingers inward, yanking his hands together, vicing the forearm beneath his blood-soaked neck and wrenched the arm diagonally up. The knife creased the cloth of his field jacket and once above his chest. Bourne spiraled the arm downward, twisting the wrist now in his grip, crashing his shoulder into the assassin's body, yanking again as Carlos plunged sideways off balance, his arm pulled half out of its socket. Jason heard the clatter of the knife on the floor. He lurched toward the sound, at the same time reaching into his belt for his gun. It caught on the cloth. He rolled on the floor, but not quickly enough. The steel toe of a shoe crashed into the side of his head, his temple, and shock waves bolted through him. He rolled again, faster. Faster until he smashed into the wall. Coiling upward on his knee, trying to focus through the weaving, obscure shadows in the near total darkness. The flesh of a hand was caught in the thin line of light from the window. He lunged at it, his own hands now claws, his arms battering rams. He gripped the hand, snapping it back, breaking the wrist. A scream filled the room. A scream and the hollow, lethal cough of a gunshot. An ice-like incision had been made in Bourne's upper left chest, the bullet lodged somewhere near his shoulder blade. In agony, he crouched and sprang again, pummeling the killer with a gun into the wall above a sharp-edged piece of furniture. Carlos lunged away as two more muted shots were fired wildly. Jason dove to his left, freeing his gun, leveling it at the sounds in the darkness. He fired, the explosion deafening, useless. He heard the door crash shut. The killer had raced out into the hallway. Trying to fill his lungs with air, Bourne crawled toward the door. As he reached it, instinct commanded him to stay at the side and smash his fist into the wood at the bottom. What followed was the core of a terrifying nightmare. There was a short burst of automatic gunfire as the paneled wood splintered, fragments flying across the room. The instant it stopped, Jason raised his own weapon and fired diagonally through the door. The burst was repeated. Bourne spun away, pressing his back against the wall. The eruption stopped, and he fired again. There were now two men, inches from each other, wanting above all to kill each other. Cain is for Charlie, and Delta is for Cain. Get Carlos. Trap
Carlos. Kill Carlos.
And then they were not inches from each other. Jason heard racing footsteps, then the sounds of a railing being broken as a figure lurched down the staircase. Carlos was racing below. The pig animal wanted support. He was hurt. Bourne wiped the blood from his face, from his throat, and moved in front of what was left of the door. He pulled it open and stepped out into the narrow corridor, his gun leveled in front of him. Painfully, he made his way toward the top of the dark staircase. Suddenly, he heard shouts below.
What the hell you doing, man? Pete! Pete!
Two metallic coughs filled the air.
Joey! Joey!
A single spit was heard. Bodies crashed to a floor somewhere below.
Jesus! Jesus, mother of—
Two metallic coughs again, followed by a guttural cry of death. A third man was killed. What had that third man said? Two wise-ass stiffs and now four crumballs. The moving van was a Carlos operation. The assassin had brought two soldiers with him, the first three crumballs from the shape-up. Three men with weapons, and he was one with a single gun, cornered on the top floor of the brownstone. Still, Carlos was inside. Inside. If he could get out, it would be Carlos who was cornered. If he could get out. Out! There was a window at the front end of the hallway, obscured by a black shade. Jason veered toward it, stumbling, holding his neck, creasing his shoulder so to blunt the pain in his chest. He ripped the shade from its spindle. The window was small, the glass here, too, thick, prismatic blocks of purple and blue light shooting through it. It was unbreakable, the frame riveted in place. There was no way he could smash a single pane. And then his eyes were drawn below to 71st Street. The moving van was gone. Someone had to have driven it away. One of Carlos' soldiers. That left two. Two men, not three. And he was on the high ground. There were always advantages on the high ground. Grimacing, bent partially over, Bourne made his way to the first door on the left. It was parallel to the top of the staircase. He opened it and stepped inside. From what he could see, it was an ordinary bedroom. Lamps, heavy furniture, pictures on the walls. He grabbed the nearest lamp, ripped the cord from the wall, and carried it out to the railing. He raised it above his head and hurled it down, stepping back as metal and glass crashed below. There was another burst of gunfire, the bullets shredding the ceiling, cutting a path in the plaster. Jason screamed, letting the scream fade into a cry, the cry into a prolonged, desperate wail, and then silence. He edged his way to the rear of the railing. He waited. Silence. It happened. He could hear the slow, cautious footsteps. The killer had been on the second floor landing. The footsteps came closer, became louder. A faint shadow appeared on the dark wall. Now. Bourne sprang out of his recess and fired four shots in rapid succession at the figure on the staircase. A line of bullet holes and eruptions of blood appeared diagonally across the man's collar. The killer spun, roaring in anger and pain as his neck arched back and his body plummeted down the steps until it was still, sprawled face up across the bottom three steps. In his hands was a deadly automatic field machine gun with a rod and brace for a stock. Now! Jason ran over to the top of the staircase and raced down, holding the railing, trying to keep whatever was left of his balance. He could not waste a moment. He might not find another. If he was going to reach the second floor, it was now, in the immediate aftermath of the soldier's death. And as he leaped over the dead body, Bourne knew it was a soldier. It was not Carlos. The man was tall, and his skin was white, very white. His features Nordic or Northern European, in no way Latin. Jason ran into the hallway of the second floor, seeking the shadows, hugging the wall. He stopped, listening. There was a sharp scrape in the distance, a brief scratch from below. He knew what he had to do now. The assassin was on the first floor, and the sound had not been deliberate. It had not been loud enough or prolonged enough to signify a trap. Carlos was injured. A smashed kneecap or a broken wrist could disorient him to the point where he might collide with a piece of furniture or brush against a wall with a weapon in his hand, briefly losing his balance as Bourne was losing his. It was what he needed to know. Jason dropped to a crouch and crept back to the staircase, to the dead body sprawled across the steps. He had to pause for a moment. He was losing strength, too much blood. He tried to squeeze the flesh at the top of his throat and press the wound in his chest. Anything to stem the bleeding. It was futile. To stay alive, he had to get out of the brownstone, away from the place where Cain was born. Jason born. There was no humor in the word association. He found his breath again, reached out and pried the automatic weapon from the dead man's hands. He was ready. He was dying, and he was ready. Get Carlos. Trap Carlos. Kill Carlos. He could not get out. He knew that. Time was not on his side. The blood would drain out of him before it happened. The end was the beginning. Cain was for Carlos, and Delta was for Cain. Only one agonizing question remained. Who was Delta? It did not matter. It was behind him now. Soon there would be darkness, not violent, but peaceful. Freedom from that question. And with his death, Marie would be free. His love would be free. Decent men would see to it, led by a decent man in Paris whose son had been killed on Rue de Bac, whose life had been destroyed by an assassin's whore. Within the next few minutes, thought Jason, silently checking the clip in the automatic weapon, he would fulfill his promise to that man, carry out the agreement he had with men he did not know. By doing both, the proof was his. Jason Bourne had died once on this day. He would die again, but would take Carlos out with him. He was ready. He lowered himself to a prone position and crept, hands over elbows, toward the top of the staircase. He could smell the blood beneath him, the sweet, bland odor penetrating his nostrils, informing him of a practicality. Time was running out. He reached the top step, pulling his legs under him, digging into his pocket for one of the road flares he had purchased at the Army-Navy store on Lexington Avenue. He knew now why he had felt the compulsion to buy them. He was back in the unremembered Tom Kwan, forgotten except for brilliant, blinding flashes of light. The flares had reminded him of that fragment of memory. They would light up a jungle now. He uncoiled the waxed fuse from the small round recess in the flare head, brought it to his teeth, and bit through the cord, shortening the fuse to less than an inch. He reached into his other pocket and took out a plastic lighter. He pressed it against the flare, gripping both in his left hand. Then he angled the rod and the brace of the weapon into his right shoulder, shoving the curved strip of metal into the cloth of his blood-soaked field jacket. It was secure. He stretched out his legs and, snake-like, started down the final flight of steps, head below, feet above, his back scraping the wall. He reached the midpoint of the staircase. Silence. Darkness. All the lights had been extinguished. Lights. Light? Where were the rays of sunlight he had seen in that hallway only minutes ago? They had streamed through a pair of French doors at the far end of the room. That room, beyond the corridor. But he could see only darkness now. The door had been shut. The door beneath him, the only other door in that hallway, was also closed, marked by a thin shaft of light at the bottom. Carlos was making him choose. Behind which door? Or was the assassin using a better strategy? Was he in the darkness of the narrow hallway itself? Bourne felt a stabbing jolt of pain in his shoulder blade, then an eruption of blood that drenched the flannel shirt beneath his field jacket. Another warning. There was very little time. He braced himself against the wall, the weapon leveled at the thin posts of the railing, aimed down into the darkness of the corridor. Now. He pulled the trigger. The staccato explosions tore the posts apart as the railing fell, the bullets shattering the walls and the door beneath him. He released the trigger, slipping his hand under the scalding barrel, grabbing the plastic lighter with his right hand, the flare in his left. He spun the flint. The wick took fire, and he put it to the short fuse. He pulled his hand back to the weapon and squeezed the trigger again, blowing away everything below. A glass chandelier crashed to a floor somewhere. Singing whines of ricochets filled the darkness. And then, light. Blinding light as the flare ignited, firing the jungle, lighting up the trees and the walls, the hidden paths and the mahogany corridors. The stench of death and the jungle was everywhere. And he was there. Almanac to Delta. Almanac to Delta. Abandon. Abandon. Never. Not now. Not at the end. Cain is for Carlos and Delta is for Cain. Trap Carlos. Kill Carlos. Bourne rose to his feet, his back pressed against the wall, the flare in his left hand, the exploding weapon in his right. He plunged down into the carpeted underbrush, kicking the door in front of him open, shattering silver frames and trophies that flew off tables and shelves into the air. Into the trees. He stopped. There was no one in that quiet, soundproof, elegant room. No one in the jungle path. He spun around and lurched back into the hallway, puncturing the walls with a prolonged burst of gunfire. No one. The door at the end of the narrow, dark corridor. Beyond was the room where Cain was born. Where Cain would die, but not alone. He held his fire, shifting the flare to his right hand beneath the weapon, reaching into his pocket for the second flare. He pulled it out and again uncoiled the fuse and brought it to his teeth, severing the cord, now millimeters from its point of contact with the gelatinous incendiary. He shoved the first flare to it. The explosion of light was so bright it pained his eyes. Awkwardly, he held both flares in his left hand and, squinting, his legs and arms losing the battle for balance, approached the door. It was open, the narrow crack extending from top to bottom on the lock side. The assassin was accommodating, but as he looked at that door, Jason instinctively knew one thing about it that Carlos did not know. It was a part of his past, a part of the room where Cain was born. He reached down with his right hand, bracing the weapon between his forearm and his hip, and gripped the knob. Now. He shoved the door open 6 inches and hurled the flares inside. A long staccato burst from a Sten gun echoed throughout the room, throughout the entire house, 1,000 dead sounds forming a running chord beneath as sprays of bullets embedded in a lead shield backed by a steel plate in the door. The firing stopped. A final clip expended. Now. Bourne whipped his hand back to the trigger, crashed his shoulder into the door, and lunged inside, firing in circles as he rolled on the floor, swinging his legs counterclockwise. Gunshots were returned wildly as Jason honed his weapon toward the source. A roar of fury burst from blindness across the room. It accompanied Bourne's realization that the drapes had been drawn, blocking out the sunlight from the French doors. Then, why was there so much light? Magnified light beyond the sizzling blindness of the flares. It was overpowering, causing explosions in his head, sharp bolts of agony at his temples. The screen. The huge screen was pulled down from its bulging recess in the ceiling, drawn taut to the floor, the wide expanse of glistening silver, a white-hot shield of ice-cold fire. He plunged behind the large hatch table to the protection of a copper dry bar. He rose and jammed the trigger back in another burst, a final burst. The last clip had run out. He hurled the weapon by its rod stock across the room at the figure in white overalls and a white silk scarf that had fallen below his face. The face. He knew it. He had seen it before. Where? Where? Was it Marseille? Yes. No. Zurich? Paris? Yes and no. Then it struck him at that instant in the blinding, vibrating light that the face across the room was known to many, not just him. But from where? Where? As so much else, he knew it and did not know it. But he did know it. It was only the name he could not find. He spiraled back off his feet, behind the heavy copper dry bar. Gunshots came. Two. Three. The second bullet tearing the flesh of his left forearm. He pulled his automatic from his belt. He had three shots left. One of them had to find its mark. Carlos. There was a debt to pay in Paris, and a contract to fulfill, his love far safer with the assassin's death. He took the plastic lighter from his pocket, ignited it, and held it beneath a bar rag suspended from a hook. The cloth caught fire. He grabbed it and threw it to his right as he dove to his left. Carlos fired at the flaming rag as Bourne spun to his knees, leveling his gun, pulling the trigger twice. The figure buckled, but did not fall. Instead, he crouched, then sprang like a white panther diagonally forward, his hands outstretched. What was he doing? Then Jason knew. The assassin gripped the edge of the huge silver screen, ripping it from its metal bracket in the ceiling, pulling it downward with all his weight and strength. It floated down above Bourne, filling his vision, blocking everything else from his mind. He screamed as the shimmering silver descended over him, suddenly more frightened of it than of Carlos or of any other human being on the earth. It terrified him, infuriated him, splitting his mind in fragments. Images flashed across his eyes, and angry voices shouted in his ears. He aimed his gun and fired at the terrible shroud. As he slashed his hand against it wildly, pushing the rough silver cloth away, he understood. He had fired his last shot. His last. As a legend named Cain, Carlos knew by sight and by sound every weapon on earth. He had counted the gunshots. The assassin loomed above him, the automatic in his hand aimed at Jason's head. Your execution, Delta, on the day scheduled. For everything you've done. Bourne arched his back, rolling furiously to his right. At least he would die in motion. Gunshots filled the shimmering room, hot needles slicing across his neck, piercing his legs, cutting up to his waist. Roll. Roll! Suddenly the gunshots stopped, and in the distance he could hear repeated sounds of hammering, the smashing of wood and steel, growing louder, more insistent. There was a final deafening crash from the dark corridor outside the library, followed by men shouting, running, and beyond them, somewhere in the unseen, outside world, the insistent whine of sirens. In here! He's in here! Screamed Carlos. It was insane. The assassin was directing the invaders directly toward him. To him. Reason was madness. Nothing on earth made sense. The door was crashed open by a tall man in a black overcoat. Someone was with him, but Jason could not see. The mists were filling his eyes, shapes and sounds becoming obscured, blurred. He was rolling in space. Away. Away. But then he saw the one thing he did not want to see. Rigid shoulders that floated above a tapered waist raced out of the room and down the dimly lit corridor. Carlos. His screams had sprung the trap open.
He had reversed it. In the chaos, he had trapped the stalkers. He was escaping.
Carlos. Bourne knew he could not be heard. What emerged from his bleeding throat was a whisper. He tried again, forcing the sound from his stomach.
It's him. It's Carlos.
There was confusion. Commands shouted futilely, orders swallowed in consternation. And then a figure came into focus. A man was limping toward him, a cripple who had tried to kill him in a cemetery outside of Paris. There was nothing left. Jason lurched, crawling toward the sizzling, blinding flare. He grabbed it and held it as though it were a weapon, aiming it at the killer with a cane.
Come on. Come on. Closer, you bastard. I'll burn your eyes out. You think you'll kill me? You won't. I'll kill you. I'll burn your eyes.
You don't understand, said the trembling voice of the limping killer.
It's me, Delta.
It's Conklin. I was wrong. The flare singed his hands, his eyes.
Madness.
The explosions were all around him now, blinding, deafening, punctuated by ear-splitting screeches from the jungle that erupted with each detonation. The jungle. Tom Kwan. The wet, hot stench was everywhere, but they had reached it. The base camp was theirs. An explosion to his left. He could see it. High above the ground, suspended between two trees, the spikes of a bamboo cage. The figure inside was moving. He was alive. Get to him. Reach him. A cry came from his right. Breathing, coughing in the smoke, a man was limping toward the dense underbrush, a rifle in his hand. It was him. The blonde hair caught in the light, a foot broken from a parachute jump. The bastard. A piece of filth who had trained with them, studied the maps with them, flown north with them, all the time springing a trap on them. A traitor with a radio who told the enemy exactly where to look in that impenetrable jungle that was Tom Kwan. It was Bourne. Jason Bourne. Traitor. Garbage. Get him. Don't let him reach others. Kill him. Kill Jason Bourne. He is your enemy. Fire! He did not fall. The head that had been blown apart was still there, coming toward him.
What was happening? Madness. Tom Kwan.
Come with us, said the limping figure, walking out of the jungle into what remained of an elegant room. That room. We are not your enemies. Come with us.
Get away from me.
Bourne lunged again, now back to the fallen screen. It was his sanctuary, his shroud of death, the blanket thrown over a man at birth, a lining for his coffin.
You are my enemy. I'll take you all. I don't care. It doesn't matter. Can't you understand? I'm Delta. Kane is for Charlie and Delta is for Kane. What more do you want from me? I was and I was not. I am and I am not. Bastards. Bastards. Come on. Closer.
Another voice was heard. A deeper voice, calmer, less insistent. Get her. Bring her in. Somewhere in the distance, the sirens reached a crescendo, and then they stopped. Darkness came, and the waves carried Jason up to the night sky, only to hurl him down again, crashing him into an abyss of watery violence. He was entering an eternity of weightless memory. An explosion filled the night sky now. A fiery diadem rose above black waters. And then he heard the words, spoken from the clouds, filling the earth.
Jason, my love, my only love, take my hand. Hold it tightly, Jason. Tightly, my darling.
Peace came with the darkness. Epilogue. Brigadier General Crawford put the file folder down on the couch beside him. I don't need this, he said to Marie Saint-Jacques, who sat across from him in a straight-back chair. I've gone over it and over it, trying to find out where we missed.
You presumed where no one should, said the only other person in the hotel suite.
He was Dr. Morris Panoff, psychiatrist. He stood by the window, the morning sun streaming in, putting his expressionless face in shadow.
I allowed you to presume, and I'll live with it for the rest of my life.
It's nearly 2 weeks now, said Marie impatiently. I'd like specifics. I think I'm entitled to them.
You are. It was an insanity called clearance.
Insanity, agreed Panoff.
Protection also, added Crawford. I subscribe to that part. It has to continue for a very long time.
Protection?
Marie frowned. We'll get to it, said the general, glancing at Panoff. From everyone's point of view, it's vital. I trust we all accept that.
Please. Jason, who is he?
His name is David Webb. He was a career Foreign Service officer, a specialist in Far Eastern affairs until his separation from the government 5 years ago.
Separation?
Resignation by mutual agreement. His work in Medusa precluded any sustained career in the State Department. Delta was infamous. And too many knew he was Webb. Such men are rarely welcome at the diplomatic conference tables. I'm not sure they should be. Visceral wounds are reopened too easily with their presence.
He was everything they say. In Medusa?
Yes. I was there. He was everything they say.
It's hard to believe, said Marie.
He'd lost something very special to him, and couldn't come to grips with it. He could only strike out.
What was that?
His family. His wife was a Thai. They had 2 children, a boy and a girl. He was stationed in Phnom Penh, his house on the outskirts near the Mekong River. One Sunday afternoon, while his wife and children were down at their dock, a stray aircraft circled and dove, dropping 2 bombs and strafing the area. By the time he reached the river, the dock was blown away, his wife and children floating in the water, their bodies riddled.
Oh, God, whispered Marie. Whom did the plane belong to?
It was never identified. Hanoi disclaimed it. Saigon said it wasn't ours. Remember, Cambodia was neutral. No one wanted to be responsible. Webb had to strike out. He headed for Saigon and trained for Medusa. He brought a specialist's intellect to a very brutal operation. He became Delta.
Was that when he met D'Anjou?
Later on, yes. Delta was notorious by then. North Vietnamese intelligence had put an extraordinary price on his head, and it's no secret that among our own people a number hoped they'd succeed. Then Hanoi found out that Webb's younger brother was an army officer in Saigon, and having studied Delta, knowing the brothers were close, decided to mount a trap. They had nothing to lose. They kidnapped Lieutenant Gordon Webb and took him north, sending back a Kong informant with word that he was being held in the Tam Quan sector. Delta bit. Along with the informer, a double agent, he formed a team of Medusans who knew the area and picked a night when no aircraft should have left the ground to fly north. D'Anjou was in the unit. So was another man Webb didn't know about. A white man who'd been bought by Hanoi, an expert in communications who could assemble the electronic components of a high-frequency radio in the dark. Which is exactly what he did, betraying the unit's position. Webb broke through the trap and found his brother. He also found the double agent and the white man. The Vietnamese escaped in the jungle. The white man didn't. Delta executed him on the spot.
And that man?
Marie's eyes were riveted on Crawford. Jason Bourne. A Medusan from Sydney, Australia. A runner of guns, narcotics, and slaves throughout all Southeast Asia. A violent man with a criminal record who was nevertheless highly effective. If the price were high enough. It was in Medusa's interests to bury the circumstances of his death. He became an MIA from a specialized unit. Years later, when Treadstone was being formed and Webb called back, it was Webb himself who took the name of Bourne. It fit the requirements of authenticity, traceability. He took the name of the man who'd betrayed him, the man he had killed in Tam Quan.
Where was he when he was called back for Treadstone? Asked Marie. What was he doing?
Teaching in a small college in New Hampshire. Living an isolated life. Some said destructive. For him. Crawford picked up the file folder. Those are the essential facts, Miss Saint-Jacques. Other areas will be covered by Dr. Panov, who's made it clear that my presence is not required. There is, however, one remaining detail which must be thoroughly understood. It's a direct order from the White House.
The protection, said Marie, her words a statement.
Yes. Wherever he goes, regardless of the identity he assumes or the success of his cover, he'll be guarded around the clock. For as long as it takes. Even if it never happens.
Please explain that.
He's the only man alive who's ever seen Carlos. As Carlos. He knows his identity, but it's locked away in his mind. Part of an unremembered past. We understand from what he says that Carlos is someone known to many people. A visible figure in a government somewhere, or in the media, or international banking, or society. It fits with a prevalent theory. The point is, one day that identity may come into focus for Webb. We realize you've had several discussions with Dr. Panov. I believe he'll confirm what I've said. Marie turned to the psychiatrist.
Is it true, Mo?
It's possible, said Panov.
Crawford left, and Marie poured coffee for the two of them. Panov went to the couch where the brigadier had been sitting.
It's still warm, he said, smiling.
Crawford was sweating right down to his famous backsides. He has every right to.
They all do. What's going to happen?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing until I tell them they can go ahead. And that may not be for months. A couple of years, for all I know. Not until he's ready.
For what?
The questions. And photographs. Volumes of them. They're compiling a photographic encyclopedia based on the loose description he gave them. Don't get me wrong. One day he'll have to begin. He'll want to. We'll all want him to. Carlos has to be caught, and it's not my intention to blackmail them into doing nothing. Too many people have given too much. He's given too much. But right now he comes first. His head comes first.
That's what I mean. What's going to happen to him?
Panov put down his coffee. I'm not sure yet. I've too much respect for the human mind to deal you
chicken soup psychology. There's too damn much of it floating around in the wrong hands. I've been in on all the conferences. I insisted upon that, and I've talked to the other shrinks and the neurosurgeons. It's true we can go in with a knife and reach the storm centers, reduce the anxieties, bring a kind of peace to him, even bring him back to what he was, perhaps. But it's not the kind of peace he wants. And there's a far more dangerous risk. We might wipe away too much, take away the things he has found. We'll continue to find. With care. With time.
Time?
I believe it, yes. Because the pattern's been established. There's growth, the pain of recognition, and the excitement of discovery. Does that tell you something? Marie looked into Panov's dark, weary eyes. There was a light in them.
All of us, she said.
That's right. In a way, he's a functioning microcosm of us all. I mean, we're all trying to find out who the hell we are, aren't we? Marie went to the front window in the cottage on the waterfront, with the rising dunes behind it, the fenced-off grounds surrounding it, and guards. Every 50 feet, a man with a gun. She could see him several hundred yards down the beach. He was scaling shells over the water, watching them bounce across the waves that gently lapped into the shore. The weeks had been good to him, for him. His body was scarred but whole again, firm again. The nightmares were still there, and moments of anguish kept coming back during the daylight hours, but somehow it was all less terrifying. He was beginning to cope. He was beginning to laugh again. Panov had been right. Things were happening to him. Images were becoming clearer, meaning found where there had been no meaning before. Something had happened now. Oh God, what was it? He had thrown himself into the water and was thrashing around, shouting. Then suddenly he sprang out, leaping over the waves onto the beach. In the distance, by the barbed wire fence, a guard spun around, a rifle whipped up under an arm, a handheld radio pulled from a belt. He began racing across the wet sand toward the house, his body lurching, swaying, his feet digging furiously into the soft surface, sending up sprays of water and sand behind him.
What was it?
Marie froze. Prepared for the moment they knew might come one day, prepared for the sound of gunfire. He burst through the door, chest heaving, gasping for breath. He stared at her, his eyes as clear as she had ever seen them. He spoke softly, so softly she could barely hear him. But she did hear him.
My name is David.
She walked slowly toward him.
Hello, David,
she said.
You have been listening to an Orion Publishing audiobook. To find out more about Orion's audiobooks, please go to the website at orionbooks.co.uk.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.